The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Well, by this time tomorrow, we will know what the interest rate pronouncement is. It's been brought forward a day because Thursday is kind of a half day for the whole country. Well, for most of the country, except us here on The Money Show, of course, because we'll be here on Thursday. But you will be kept well informed and well connected and well kept in touch with everything you need to know. But yeah, so that Reserve Bank Monetary Policy Committee will be happening tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. And of course, you'll get the news as soon as it breaks. I anticipate it. We won't get any change in interest rates. And we will get a warning from the governor of state dysfunction and the increased cost of moving goods and services around the country and the consequences of electricity failure and all of the regular stuff that he talks about in order to as to why South African inflation is sitting at 5.3% and rising when many parts of the world, of course, inflation is falling, and whether he'll give us any indication, of course, as to whether or not rates will come down in the second half of this year. I cannot be sure about that. But certainly look forward to his analysis of the state of the nation. We'll also, in a moment, talk to the outgoing chief executive at EOH, Stephen van Coller. We'll talk to a South African-born entrepreneur. She and a business partner have just raised 75 million rands, but they've done it in pounds, and it is the biggest capital raise by women-led business in Europe ever. And it is for a fledgling organization anyway. Lots of technicalities here, but it is an exciting investment platform that behavioral economist Samantha Rosenberg is going to talk to us about this evening. And we'll also talk about the crumbling cement industry in South Africa. And very importantly, for 99% of us, what happens if your financial plans have gone awry? You thought that you had a good plan and markets haven't acted in the way you thought they would. You didn't managed to keep up your investments. Something went wrong along the way. There was a divorce or two. Whatever has befallen you, life happens and these things fall apart. At what point do you give up and just then go and buy lottery tickets, if ever? Warren Ingram tonight, 7:30 here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Have you ever been on a long hike and you've packed your bag with all the essentials? You've got your map, you've got your GPS, just in case the battery goes flat, you've got a map, you've checked out the route, you know what weather to expect, but about 2 hours into your hike, your shoelace snaps. But that's not enough for you to give up. So it's a warning that things aren't going your way, but you make a plan and you tie an extra knot in your shoes and you keep on going. You feel that the wind is changing direction and actually the weather is not playing out like the forecaster suggested. And by the time you're 2 hours into your hike, there's a massive rock fall blocking your route. And by the time you get halfway around the hike, you've got 2 hours overdue. You're exhausted. You're halfway though. It's too late to go back and you simply soldier on to the end. I wonder if you've ever been in that situation. Stephen van Coller, the outgoing chief executive of EOH, I think has been in that position. Does your time at EOH feel a bit like that, Stephen van Coller, where you've gone on this long hike and just so many things have gone wrong on the route? And, you know, by the time you realized you were in deep trouble, it was too late to back out.
Bruce. Well, it's certainly been an epic journey and certainly there have been unexpected things along the way, but I think if you think of everything we've been through, whether it was the bribery and corruption, the COVID, the riots, the flooding, the Ukrainian war, the political issues, it has been, to say the least, interesting. But what they say doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and I think I've learned an enormous amount, and I think the team has as well, so I've no regrets.
Maybe you embarked on this role. You left a powerful job in investment banking. You joined a very impressive array of A-types that were the ex-co at MTN under Rob Shooter. Then the EOH job came up and you grabbed it. You knew what you knew and you didn't know what you didn't know. Would you, with retrospect, the gift of hindsight, have made a different choice considering the career path you were on and the really big obstacles that were thrust at you in the EOH job?
Yeah, it's, it, interesting question. I mean, obviously, if I'd known about the bribery and corruption, I don't think anyone in their right mind would have gone in, because that's a very, very, very difficult thing from a culture perspective, with your customers, with your perception in the market. I mean, people still try and have a look at what the share price was in the beginning to what it is now. I mean, it's just irrelevant, because it was just such a big change. But the attraction of EOH was just really where it was. It had to be turned around. It was these 283 small businesses. We've squashed those together now into three main businesses. It's been a long journey. And it's really starting now to function as a real business. And I think that's quite satisfying. And even though, you know, we were forced to sell some businesses that we didn't want to sell, we've at least saved those jobs and saved those businesses by selling them out of the group, and obviously bought a lot of debt down, where I've had the bank CEOs thank me for saving depositors' money, because it was a huge amount of money when we got there and is much more manageable now. So there's a lot of satisfaction in doing it. And as I say, I mean, I wrote about climbing Everest. You know, when you climb up and you fall off and you lose a few toes and get frostbite, it's a bit harrowing. But when you come down and you look back, you say, wow, that was a great journey. Not sure I want to do it again, but I've learned a lot. And I think that's where I am.
Just confirm that statistic for me, please. You take over, there are 283 companies, which you've now distilled down to three operating entities.
Yeah, so basically there's 100 legal entities left, of which 40 are in SIPC for deregistration and various phases. There's 60 operational at the moment. And now that we... And if you remember, I wasn't allowed to really touch those while we had four banks. When we did the rights issue, we ended up only with one bank, and that then allowed us, because of the security package, to start unpicking those, which we have. And you've seen the cost result. You know, we gave an inflationary increase and we still saved. We're down 3% year on year, which I think is quite astonishing. But now with the SAR settlement on Heifeld, we can now do the last third of the business, which is the business Fatima runs, and so we can take that even further. And because of the OEMs and your certifications and your licenses on that, you probably get it down to somewhere between 30 to 40 companies, but that's very different to 283 companies and 900 budgeting units. That's what EOH was when I got there. Crazy.
I mean, it was heralded in its day. It was heralded in its day as a work of genius. It was this amalgamation of great little businesses. It was high performing. These were businesses that were run by self-starters and management teams that ran their own books and ran their own balance sheets. But ultimately, it created plenty of places, I'm sure, for people to hide. And there was no way on earth that any board and any chief executive and any chair of any company could possibly have kept that many balls up in the air at once in terms of juggling and ensuring governance and ensuring systems and processes. It created so much opportunity for corruption, didn't it?
The problem was, Bruce, is that they never integrated hardly anything. They didn't create new systems. They didn't create new governance processes. They just bought them and let them on. And one of the... I think the big failings for me was you buy a business from an entrepreneur, you give them three-year targets to get paid their full amount of money. So you can decide whether they were totally focused on just getting those targets. But then the entrepreneurs, after the 3 years, they're getting a salary and a small bonus. That's not what an entrepreneur wants. And so this was always going to have a negative effect at some point, unless you consolidate it, put new leadership in, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was the big conundrum they were facing. And I think that's why they originally reached out to me. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you go in there with your eyes wide open and you only know what's, you know, going wrong with the engine once you get an opportunity to lift the bonnet. You lifted the bonnet, you saw what was going on. And there were a couple of occasions along the way where you expressed personal confidence by investing money in EOH shares. I'm not going to mention numbers here, but the numbers were considerably higher than they are at the moment. You put your own money in saying, I have confidence that I can turn this business around. And it just felt like, you know, almost at every turn, there was somebody, you know, I don't know, somebody laughing at you going, you think you're in control, but you're not really. And that must have been a horrible shock as you uncovered more and more of what was wrong within the business.
No, it was a horrible shock. I mean, the first thing is I put my money in at the beginning when it was just an operational turnaround and I didn't know about the bribery and corruption. So that was a massive shock because that's a very difficult thing because now you're a services business selling people's time people are going, well, we're not sure about this company anymore. So I had to put a lot of my personal, obviously, legacy or whatever you want to call it on the line and actually get mucking in. But it was a huge shock. I mean, I'd grown up in multinationals. You get covered or hidden from those things, you know, and suddenly you're in the middle of it and you see the real dark side of life for sure.
It's a business you've reshaped, and you talk today about the final legacy issue. It was an issue with SARS finally being put to bed. That's got to be very satisfying, but the financial performance can't be what you hope to achieve. I mean, the business in the last 6 months, for various reasons, a restructuring of contracts and customers aren't paying and times are tough in the general economy, but you've reported a loss in these 6 months. And, you know, you talk about skill shortages in technology. It's a tough environment to be handing over a business to your successors.
Yeah, it is a very tough environment. But if you actually unpack the numbers, it was actually the second half of last year that was the difficult half. We showed 29% margins in the first half and 28% for the full year, which essentially showed you GP margins of 27% for the second half. We've actually grown revenue from the second half of last year by 6%, et cetera. So we've actually, I think, come through the bottom of it. 2023, for the year of 2023, was very, very difficult. But as we got into 2024, December, January, were actually decent months, and that's really pulled us back. So if you have a look underneath, the business is still good. I mean, if you have a look at our margins, there's a slide in our presentation showing our EBITDA margins. I mean, they're all high 20s to low 30s. There's a lot of companies who would love to have those gross profit margins. So the businesses are good. It's just the structure that we have to continue to optimize, and that was obviously slowed down by waiting for the rights issue, waiting for the SARS settlement. But you saw we've already taken 50 million out from last year. We've managed to sell some of the non-core to plug this big hole that SARS has created, and so that will be done. And then we've just got to hope that the economy turns, and because we're very correlated to it. We normally outperform in the upturn, and we're quite defensive in the downturn. So this isn't the worst thing we've had to face by far in the last 5 years. So we still generated 31 million rands worth of cash, managed our debtors flat. I mean, the business is very well run. There's not a lot more that I can do to drive it now that Marius, Fatima and Brian, you know, they've been running their businesses for the last 18 months and they've been with me for 4 to 4.5 years. So at some point you have to move out the top and let them rise and shine. So hopefully they'll do even better than I did. And I can get some of my hard-earned invested money back from the company.
Hopefully you don't have to be too patient. Thank you, Stephen van Coller, the outgoing chief executive at EOH this evening here on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I love this headline. Cocoa is more expensive than copper as it tops $9,000. That's bad news if you love chocolate. Good news if you want to cut back on treats. Casey Sprake is an investment analyst at Anchor Capital. And there's so many factors driving up cocoa prices, Casey. At some point, the speculators moved in, of course, and the price went exponential. The cocoa price looks like a Bitcoin graph at the moment, doesn't it? It's going up and up and up and only in one direction.
No, it's absolutely crazy at the moment. If you look at the charts, like you say, it looks like one of the worst performing cryptocurrencies out there. I think it's a bigger case of sustainability issues more than anything else. I mean, as you mentioned now, the speculators, of course, come in and distorted the numbers further. But I think the core issue of this is a lack of sustainability with the industry at whole, and of course with everything that comes with that, the global environmental concerns, etc. I mean, the majority of cocoa in the day comes from just one Bamana region, that being West Africa, with just two countries being the core producers. And you have an issue like we have now where there's some really worse weather conditions coming through, all of a sudden supply is dented. You couple this with issues of rising sugar costs, etc. And then all of a sudden that chocolate that you're buying at the till is a lot more expensive than it was a month ago.
There's a whole supply chain at risk here, isn't there? Because not only have we got a 250% increase in the price of cocoa over the past year alone, but the people who trade in it, the people who grow it, the people who distribute it, the people who move it around the world. Also, there's an entire ecosystem that is at risk. It's almost like there's a chocopop. Apocalypse or something. I can't even say the word.
No, precisely that. I mean, it was one of the more interesting headlines. Try say chocopocalypse 5 times quickly. No, precisely. The biggest producers, again, of cocoa in the world at the moment is Ivory Coast, Ghana, Nigeria, and they really produce the majority in the global production scheme. And, you know, it's not just the cost effects for us as consumers. The cocoa industry props up those entire economies. So it is actually much more of a serious issue and will have knock-on effects, as you mentioned, right through the supply chain and into local economies and the regional African economies as well.
These shortages, and I mean, the cocoa input into chocolate, fortunately, is quite small. I think it's 15% of the price of an average chocolate bar. But over the last year, sugar prices have gone mad as well. The cost of distribution, the cost of logistics, everything else. I mean, the fact is, we're probably all going to have to pay a lot more for sweet treats into the future, which will make dietitians happy, but not many other people.
No, that's precisely it. I mean, what we're seeing at the moment, the current situation is almost a perfect storm, to be honest, for chocolate sort of confectionery manufacturers. As you mentioned, they've recently been managing high sugar prices. You know, while those have eased in recent months, it's simply just been completely wiped out by the extremely high cocoa future prices, which are really just, you know, notching successive record highs at the moment. Taking into account the generally higher sort of transport freight cost that we've been seeing as part of the global economy over the last year or two, and it's really, really pushing prices further. Luckily for, you know, within the general inflationary basket for South Africans, that's always the key determinant, right? It's a very small portion of our overall basket. But for the average consumer, such as yourself and myself, who love a little sweet treat, it's just a further element to really dent our consumer pockets at the end of the day.
Well, we could just give up, like sensible people would. Casey Sprague, thank you. Investment analyst at Anchor Capital. Wonderful analysis of a real world problem that is going to have an impact on your back pocket or your teeth or your waistline. Possibly a positive one in your waistline in this case.
The Money Show. The Markets.
To Wayne McCurry we go. He is from FNB Wealth and Investments. The EOH story has been a tragedy from superhero to superdog, I guess, Wayne McCurry. Done from, I think, you know, in the 80 rands a share 10 years ago when it was the best performing share on the JSE year after year after year to 1 rand and 11 cents today.
Look, it's down 95%, I think, over the last 5 years. It has been a tragedy. When you think of it, how it was mentioned in the state capture report that they paid 850 million rands worth of bribes and under-the-table cash-in-hand sort of thing. Yeah, it's a terrible story, actually.
Although, I mean, here you've got the outgoing chief executive, Stephen Van Coller, you know, hand on heart, saying that, you know, it's now in fighting shape to, you know, survive and grow from here. He's undone a monumental mess.
Yes.
We hope that it is sufficiently undone for progress into the future.
Well, they also say they've settled now with SARS about the PAYE on some subsidiary they had that processed payrolls. And they say that's the last really thing that they needed to get in place before they can actually fully implement their whole strategy. But, I mean, they still made a loss per share, you know, and the loss per share went up over the time period. So the headline loss didn't. I mean, it was still a loss. But, yeah, look, I mean, it's been, and for Stephen, it's been an unbelievably difficult task. You know, maybe there's only one more difficult task, and that was running Steinhoff. But EOH was an incredibly difficult task. You know, they are generating cash from their operations. But, I mean, it's very difficult to make a comeback you know, some of the very deep value speculative guys might look at it and say, okay, there is a turnaround coming in. They have got contracts. They do get annuity income, et cetera. But, yeah, I'm not brave enough to go.
Another company that's had its hassles, sort of implementing SAP, big governance issues, Spar.
Yes.
And Spar's also had its traditional sort of shopper hunting grounds sort of encroached upon by a rapidly expanding retail sector. And lots of issues afflicting Spar are self-inflicted, but they also are feeling the pain, of course, of no longer having a monopoly in the suburbs because there's just so much more competition come through now.
There's a lot more competition. So when you look at all of the environments, you know, there's not actually that much good news. You know, Ireland is not doing so well. Switzerland, everyone's going across the border to shop with a very strong currency. They'd rather cross the border shop in neighboring countries because it's so much cheaper than actually shopping in Switzerland. I mean, the turnover was down 5%, and that's one of the main reasons for that. And in Spar South Africa, they went backwards in volume. In other words, the turnover growth was less than the internal inflation. And, of course, they still got this legacy of the KZN implementation of SAP, although they're speaking a little bit more positively about that. But, I mean, that was just a total disaster, that.
Yeah, and that was a trading update from Spar today, just reflecting all of that. And then Master Drilling's not a company we talk about often. I don't know if it's one that you watch, but it's a little company that gets a little attention, but it's got a massive reputation by those who like the smaller shares on the JSE, and it's a solid little performer, isn't it?
Yes, I like this company. I've met management once or twice. I mean, I think it's the only listed company to ever come out of Hawkville, and they did quite well. You know, their dollar revenue is up 7%. Their U.S. Earnings per share were down a little bit, but the ZAR earnings were actually up. Their headline earnings in dollars were up. And this is in a commodity down cycle. Look, it's a small company. It's a 2 billion rand company, but it's sitting at a very, very low rating in the market, and maybe we should pay it more attention. I've always been very impressed by the management. They're just good, solid people. You know exactly how to run the business without any fancy frills. I quite like the company, actually.
Can we dub it the Fochville Firecracker, I wonder?
We can call it that, the Fochville Firecracker.
Wayne McCurry, thank you. Wayne is with Wealth and Investments at First National Bank.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening, a brand new investment platform. It started by, or co-founded by, a South African who, with a business partner in Europe, has raised a huge amount of money. We'll talk to Samantha Rosenberg about that in just a moment. Then a crumbling cement sector in South Africa is worth discussing as well. One-time infrastructure darlings, of course, were huge beneficiaries of the massive building boom leading up to 2010. It's all fallen apart since then, however. And Rowan Goller from Cronux Research has been looking into this sector. We'll do our Africa business focus and, of course, the signals feature, along with Warren Ingram. Personal finance, what to do when your personal financial planning has fallen flat? How do you mitigate against disaster? That's all coming up tonight on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
Well, an interesting snippet across my desk today about a new investment platform started by female founders who've just raised the largest amount of money ever before official launch by a women-run company in Europe. Belong, co-founder and chief operating officer Samantha Rosenberg, is an economist and she's specialized in behavioral finance. Born in South Africa with an MBA from the London Business School, she's teamed up with Trinidad-born chief executive and co-founder Avion Gray. You've raised, Samantha, nearly £3 million. If we translate that into real money, that's 75 million rand. That's a big pool of cash. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But where did you and Avion Gray meet and come up with this idea of fundamentally changing the way that millennials could invest into the future?
Hi, Bruce. It's great to be on the show. That was a phenomenal introduction. Thank you. How did I meet Avion? I was a business school student. And in business school, every class is a case study. I was fortunate enough for one of my case studies to be Nutmeg, which was the first regulated robo-advisor in Europe and the UK. We discussed the case, and little do we know that the founder is actually sitting at the back of the class the whole time, which led to my meeting Nick Hungerford. And I started talking to Nick Hungerford about my passion around helping people make better financial decisions. And he was helping me to find a role. And he eventually said to me after a couple of months of mentoring me that, in fact, he doesn't think that I should find another role. I should start a business based on the passion that I have. And he has someone he wants to introduce me to, which is Avion, my now co-founder. And when we asked him later on why he introduced us, he always said that we were speaking to him about the same problem, but using slightly different language. My background in behavioral economics meant that I was speaking about this problem around young people not doing enough to build wealth over the long term from a behavioral perspective, present bias. We favor the current self over the future self. Avion, on the other hand, being an investment banker with many years of experience in leveraged finance, was speaking about it from a very technical financial perspective. In order to build wealth over the long term, you need two things. You need time and money, because you need your money to compound over time. And as a generation, we're not getting into the market early enough to benefit from that compounding. So he put us together, we started chatting, and the rest is history.
And so the man sitting at the back of the class, Nick Hungerford, the man who founded Nutmeg quite a while back now, becomes one of your investors, of course, in this funding round. The way that you're going to differentiate is really interesting. And we know that wealthy people use something called leverage. Basically, they borrow money in order to make more money. And you've come up with a mechanism that'll make many old school investment types sort of quiver with fear. But this idea that you can take on a loan to scale up on your existing money to get a head start on the power of compounding. It's a compelling idea. How does it work without exposing your customers to some very serious risk?
Yes, that's something that we spent a lot of time, of course, unpacking in the early days of coming up with this idea, was how we make sure that this is something that does achieve our objective and our passion of helping people rather than putting them into any sort of financial difficulty. So first, let me say that fundamentally, we believe in the Warren Buffett approach of diversify, buy and hold. This is a long-term product. And on our platform, we currently only offer diversified index tracking funds. So there's no stock picking and no speculation. How the product works is there's a low interest loan, which allows more money to be invested up front, thus magnifying that effect of compounding that you spoke about. And then customers pay back the boost loan separately in monthly installments, allowing their investments to continue to grow while they're repaying it. So very much the structure of a mortgage, we've taken the overarching structure of a mortgage and applied that to a different asset class is how we think about this. How we ensure that our customers are not at risk. Well, there's always risk with investing. And of course that has to be made, that is always made clear to our customers. One, we need to make sure that this is their excess cash that they're investing. This is money that they can afford to put aside to invest and to leave it there. Because as long as they can leave it there and not panic when the market drops, it's excess cash, they can leave it there. The second thing is that we take our customers through a full creditworthiness assessment. So this is a fully regulated proposition. We have to make sure that customers can afford the monthly repayments on the loan, and we do a credit check. We make sure that there's a sort of suitability of the proposition when it comes to the customer. And it's really all around this being long. And because the customers are de-risking as they're repaying the loan, the being long part is really important.
And then it's a wonderful sort of play on words, of course. The company is Belong, which is you're part of a club, you're part of a fraternity, if you like, of like-minded individuals who share an investment philosophy of spreading risk and taking long-term views for the long term. And then, of course, you're not doing any fancy investment shenanigans. This is simply a buy-and-hold strategy. You're going literally long.
That's exactly it. Belong.
Talk to me then about where you are in the setup process, because you've been very, very quiet about it, but you do have customers. You do have people who've already bought into your idea. That would have given some comfort, I think, to your funders who helped you raise this much more impressive, to say, 75 million rand than 3 million pounds. In whatever currency, it's a fair amount of cash. Where are you in the building process here, Samantha?
So, Bruce, what I will say is that the announcement, the fundraise and the announcement, that was our last funding round, which we, in fact, raised off nothing but a lot of passion and a pitch deck. We have since then built the entire platform, beginning to end. We've got a team, we've got lenders signed up, we have got the licenses that we need, or the permissions that we need to launch from in terms of the regulator in the UK. And we have been running a private beta, as you say, very quietly in stealth over the last 15 months. And it's now that we decided to come out of stealth. We have the traction that we felt we needed, that this is a product that we're ready to show to the world and a proposition we're ready to put out into the public. So the funding that is in the news is our last round. We haven't gone public with our current fundraise, as that is currently being closed.
When you look back at your time at London Business School, and I think business schools universally are a bit like this, there's the useful classroom learning stuff, but the exposure that you got by being in the room and by connecting with Nick Hungerford, and unbeknown to you, your current business partner, Avion Gray, connecting with him as well, and him putting the pieces together, that wonderful sense of experience that you get access to of people who have done similar things before, who see the potential in fresh thinking, I think is probably the biggest gift that going into those sorts of places of higher learning can provide.
Of course, that's exactly it. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be educated at the University of Cape Town. I got a master's in economics there. And so going to do an MBA at London Business School, a lot of the classes I'd already done. So it wasn't really an academic experience for me. It was very much that network that you get plugged into of these incredible people. It's like the blinkers fall away and there's a whole world that you're exposed to of just true, true diversity of thought.
It's a wonderful tale. Samantha Rosenberg, all the best. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us this evening. The co-founder of a new investment platform called Be Long. Samantha Rosenberg on the line to us from London.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
On to a less happy story. The Samantha Rosenberg story has got my juices flowing. It really does. Thinking laterally about old-fashioned things and making them work differently. I'm looking forward to seeing how Be Long flies. Well, South African cement producers facing the threat of plant closures and job cuts. They're really struggling against what is a tide of cheap imports. And we have seen that they're massive, of course. I mean, even though they've got the ports broken and logistical challenges and all sorts of things, we're still getting lots of cheaper cement flowing into the country from places like Vietnam, and it's putting our local industry under a huge amount of pressure. Rowan Goller is a director at Cronux Research. I think this has been building for quite a while. I remember talking to Gloria Serobe probably 20 years ago now at Whiphold, and I was saying, what's your next big idea? No, we're going to import cement. That was her big plan, and clearly lots of people have caught on to this idea, because that reality of cement imports is on us, and the imports are being brought into the country in, I don't know, bagfuls, in container loads, in lots of it.
That they are, Bruce. Good evening, and good evening to your listeners. The cement imports, it's not a new thing for the country. It's just that they are persistent and they're coming in at high levels. And it's placing a lot of strain on the local industry, which has got its own challenges of fairly low demand at the moment. We know about the infrastructure challenges in the country. And that just adds up to a very tough environment. It's the type of environment where government really should step up and help out industry. And it's not about protectionism necessarily, it's about providing a level playing field so that you can operate and compete on level terms. And that's really what we're seeing, I think, in the cement industry, is the imports are coming in at cheap levels. They're surprisingly high levels if you look at the volumes coming through, given all the challenges we've had at the ports. Cement imports last year were up 20%. That's straight cement. If you add clinker imports into the mix, you've got almost 1.5 million tonnes coming into the country. That's over 10% of overall volume, overall demand.
It's a vast amount, of course, that is putting huge pressure on the incumbents, isn't it?
That it is. That it is. They're operating at fairly low operating margins if you just look at their businesses across the board. And it comes to a point where reinvesting in your business becomes a decision where you say, do we reinvest or do we, you know, look at alternatives, importing ourselves? It's been a real challenge against the importers. There's another aspect in South Africa where there's a lot of blended cement. Standards and the checking of standards has really fallen away over recent years. So the quality of cement is also fairly suspect. And that just makes it fairly difficult for the local for the local producers.
It's a big concern down the line, isn't it? Because if you're bringing in stuff that is sort of cut with, I don't know, beach sand or whatever the case might be, and you're not getting the same quality of stickability, this stuff is meant to last for hundreds of years. If you're building buildings out of poor cement, we run the risk of structural issues into the future, and it just doesn't seem to be a regulatory framework that is working effectively either at the ports through the protection of solid good producers, and of course down the line in terms of the quality of construction that is sort of, you know, evolving all over the country.
That, and it'll take a building to fall down probably to prove that fact. You can see it across building materials, Bruce, in the whole of South Africa. There's a general downscaling to what one has to say is substandard goods, and a lot of retailers are struggling. Take a Cashbuild, for example. ArcelorMittal when it comes to steel, the cement producers, and it's really difficult. You know, there's one thing to protect the consumer, make sure the market's competitive, but another aspect is you need to protect the consumer from substandard goods. They may be cheap, but there is a reason for that. And that's a trend that we see more and more in industrial South Africa, making the companies that produce good, solid, proper products. It just makes it a lot more difficult for them. They're just not getting that protection that they should get, and that should be normal anywhere in the world. Again, I said this is not over-protectionism, which wouldn't be a good thing. It's just being able to compete on the same footing.
Thank you to Rowan Goller, who's director at Cronux Research. A real problem brewing, and it's a problem that you don't see immediately in terms of the quality of cement that's being used in some construction, but you will see it eventually. And you'll see it in tragedies that will unfurl, and we'll go, how did that happen? It's because we weren't paying attention in the present to what can go wrong in the future. Rowan Goller, thank you. After Eyewitness News, of course, we're going to be looking at our signals feature, this time mobile virtual network operators. Your bank is your cell phone provider. There's an explosion of these things. What does it mean? And certainly what does it mean for the cell phone industry? It is a rapid, big growth area. Some analysis on that, our Africa Business Report, and then Warren Ingram on financial planning. What happens when it all goes wrong? That's after Eyewitness News.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Such an interesting story in Eyewitness News ahead of the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee meeting tomorrow, in which, of course, the Reserve Bank will be very, very cognizant of the pop crew position on wage negotiations with the public sector. Pop crew, which represents prisons and police officers, rejecting a 4.7% wage increase. Now, 4.7% ordinarily may seem like a fairly good wage increase, but with inflation above 5.5% or thereabouts, certainly there is a lot of room for members of these unions to be saying, hold on a second, but 4.5% makes us poorer. 4.7% makes us poorer. So no, we don't want to accept it. And so this is what inflation expectations are about. We talked about inflation expectations last week, of course, as our inflation expectations, while coming down, are still on the high side. And it's one of the things that the governor is going to have to address tomorrow in his talk, which he gives around the announcement of no interest rate cuts, because that I expect to happen tomorrow.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Let's talk to Ryan in Randburg. You want to just reflect a little, Ryan, on the story around cement, on imports, and the fact that the local cement industry is under a huge amount of pressure.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bruce. Good evening. Bruce, the challenge that was faced started many years ago with the monopolistic attitude of the current producers. The Big Four had monopolized the industry to such an extent that they weren't willing to allow any local manufacturers in this industry. So, and I come from the industry. I was there for many, many years. And now, you know, to cry foul on this issue of cheap imports, you know, I think it's a bit weak in terms of what they are challenging right now. Because if they had allowed local blenders into the market many, many years ago, and I think this would have mitigated some of the challenges because they would have been included with the local blenders of cement, because they hold the monopoly on a lot of the raw materials of cement.
Here's an interesting idea, Ryan. I mean, you use the term monopoly. They would probably use the term a consolidated industry. You're suggesting that they kept out competition, I don't know, through price controls. There wasn't effective regulation, so therefore the Competition Commission wasn't keeping a close enough eye on their behavior. And so naturally there would be a market for cheap imports. At the same time, however, you and I are put at risk because of the fact that we've got this inferior cement, much of it inferior, that comes into the country because it's not properly stamped, it's not properly checked. And over time, we have a real problem. What's the solution to this? Better regulation at the ports? What fixes it?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, coming from the industry, you know, back in the day, I'm talking over 20 years ago, you know, your cement needed to be tested by the Concrete Society of South Africa. And everybody understood there was a certain amount of regulation and standard that needed to be met before that cement hit the market. So that is what I am challenging, because we had a consortium that was willing to take on to add in a fifth or sixth tier of cement producers in South Africa. And that was one of the challenges that we had faced. You know, the clinker supply, the limestone, ash from certain supply. And all these doors were closed. And so that is what has allowed some of these cheap, unqualified, poor quality cement to come into the country. I still keep an eye on the cement industry simply because I have a passion for the cement industry. So, you know, that's my comment on this.
Thank you so much, Ryan in Randburg. Really appreciate your call this evening. That's what happens, I suppose. Over time, an industry gets consolidated. They don't like the competition. Everybody talks up competition. It's, oh, we really love competition. It keeps us smart, keeps us bright, keeps us focused. Really, I don't know who really loves competition all that much. You know, there's some people who lay claim to it. Certainly an industry that's seeing lots of competition is in a part of the mobile telephony market, which we're going to talk about this evening. Let's get this right. The Mobile Virtual Network Operators, MVNOs. Talking that in our Signals feature tonight.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Listening to the chief executives of South Africa's big mobile operators, and certainly with the chief executive of MTN last night, was telling us that, you know, we need consolidation in the mobile industry because that's, you know, the world is going that way, to the point we just heard about cement. Fewer and fewer larger companies controlling bigger and bigger slices of the pie. Well, they may have another thing coming because there is very, very strong data growth going, of course, in the South African market, but call volumes have been plummeting for years. Pricing is quite competitive. Well, there's a new report today that South Africa's mobile virtual network operators, the MVNOs, are seeing a very substantial amount of growth. Doing that research is Dobek Pater, the telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis. Remind us before we get into the meat and potatoes of this one, Dobek, what is an MVNO, a mobile virtual network operator?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to the listeners. Yeah, thanks for having us on the show. So a mobile virtual network operator is a mobile operator, maybe sometimes better also defined as a service provider. There are various flavors of that within that acronym. That doesn't have a license for the spectrum that mobile network operators would. So MTN, Vodacom, you know, Rain, Telkom, Cell C, sort of phasing out of that actual operator market. They have spectrum that allows them to build networks and transmit signal, the radio signal that connects you and me to the network. The virtual network operators, mobile virtual network operators, do not own that, so do not have that spectrum license. So they rely on the actual mobile network operators using their spectrum, their infrastructure to provide services. Now, they may have some of their own infrastructure. They may have their own billing systems, for instance, their own number ranges, but they don't have the full stack of network infrastructure that the operators would. They don't invest the billions of rands every year into building out that infrastructure.
So these are the banks, for example. Capitec has got a very big MVNO business. FNB has got a very big MVNO business. They're well wired, they're well connected, they've got strong customer bases, and they can sort of package up deals for their customers that it may appear more appealing than perhaps the mobile operators themselves are doing.
Well, there are two types of MVNOs, the virtual operators. They can be broadly classified into pure telecoms. So these are like mobile service providers that just offer you voice data, sometimes other value-added services. And then what we call the branded MVNOs. And these are associated with known brands. And you mentioned, you provided the example of FNB Connect, which is one of the better known ones. So these are existing entities, companies, typically, or most of the time, large financial institutions or retailers like, for instance, Pick and Pay, Mr. Price, etc., who then decide to offer these mobile telecommunication services, voice and data services, as part of the suite of services. Effectively, it's originally not meant to be a big profit and revenue contributor. It often acts as of an additional service that they provide that they can leverage the existing customer base, you know, leveraging the brand effectively to sell these additional services as part of a reward scheme where they may give those preferential terms to the existing customers.
So this is, I mean, you've got a captive market if you're a lender of any kind. You could therefore offer a compelling package. And these guys are growing hand over fist, are they? In a market where the cell phone providers, always acquire a couple of million customers here and there, these guys are sort of operating using mostly the backbone of Cell C. It's the big gorilla in this MVNO market. But they are they undermining the cell phone industry? Are they collaborating? Are they on the side of the industry? Where do they fit in terms of the landscape?
They're not undermining the telecommunications industry, and certainly not the mobile industry. They effectively offer, part of it is brand based on brand affinity. So effectively, I like FNB. I'm a loyal FNB customer, and I'll buy telecommunication services from FNB because they offer me maybe a slightly better deal, but not necessarily just through telecommunication services. Because I'm an F&B customer, I can get better deals or score additional loyalty points by using their telecommunication services that I can maybe then use for some other bank services. So they provide, it's almost a, not quite on the side of the telecommunications market, but a niche segment of the market that is expanding. And we've seen it globally actually grow quite significantly in some of the other large MVNO countries in Europe, to an extent in North America, and starting in Africa. There are other countries like Kenya, for instance, that have been doing relatively well in the MVNO market. There's a brand, for instance, called Bayeda Mobile, which tries to leverage the affinity to the Zulu nation. So if you're an ethnic Zulu, you sort of have an affinity to the Zulu nation, you may choose to be a Bayeda Mobile customer because that's where your loyalty runs and makes you feel better. You want to demonstrate your Zulu-ness through that, as one of the external points.
What are the signal we're getting from this then in terms of, are we creating clubs of mobile members? Are there almost like societies of mobile members? What is the sort of the big picture here in terms of how this mobile industry is changing and evolving over time?
I think in general, when we look at the telecommunications market and specifically the mobile telecommunications market, loyalty has been on the decline globally. So most customers are not really interested all that much whether they are using Rain or MTN or Telkom. What they're interested in is a good product. They want to get better value for money than they could from the mobile operator next door. In general, loyalty has been decreasing. What the MVNOs, the large MVNOs that have other brands in other markets, are trying to do is leverage the loyalty that they had created somewhere else, for instance, in the financial industry or the retail industry, and hopefully translate that into selling telecommunication services. So we are seeing these, from that perspective, those pockets of loyalty, but also, as you said, they come with the overall package. So it's not just telecommunication services, but the overall package that I get from that service provider. There have been some of the MVNOs over the years, and we've had 33 of them starting in South Africa and 17 that operate currently, and more on the way. Some of them were designed as specific interest groups or clubs. So there was one that supported almost a movement, cancer awareness movement that failed because they didn't really attract enough customers to be sustainable. Most of them said are not really clubs. They are leveraging the existing customer base and the brand to offer expand their suite of services, and telecommunications is one of those where they see an opportunity to use that as a sticking point to retain the existing customers and hopefully gain new customers.
Fascinating world. Thank you very much, Dobek Pater, who is the telecoms analyst at Africa Analysis, joining us this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
Our Africa Business Report is brought to you by SAA, celebrating 90 years, connecting dreams, bridging continents, and soaring higher. To Diana Games we go. She's chief executive at the business consultancy Africa at Work. And yes, we were chatting to Ralph Mupita at MTN last night, and there's no time to talk about absolutely every single aspect. You're going to zone in this evening on the real roller coaster ride MTN has endured in Nigeria, and Ralph Mupita's continued commitment to keep serving that market despite, they're not headaches, they're migraines, call them what you like. They're a big headache.
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, I think MTN has gone through a lot of stuff in Nigeria, the tax thing that happened over time. But this one is not peculiar, of course, to MTN, and this is the devaluation of the Naira, which has really hit MTN results hard in the 2023 year, as I'm sure he told you. So I'm not going to go into all of that. But especially MTN Nigeria, of course, has been hard hit. I mean, the Naira has devalued by more than 90% during the course of this year. But that roller coaster ride started pretty much around May, when the new president came into power, and he decided, actually on the advice of the IMF and many other advisors, to let the currency to take away the controls on the currency. And what happened is, of course, I think it surprised everybody how quickly it moved down and how much value it lost over time, and it's actually increased that pace of that decline has increased this year, and so of course all companies that have foreign investments in Nigeria have been reporting really poor results. But I think everybody still feels, well, I don't know what Ralph said obviously, but I think there's still a view that that the president is holding the line on the basis that at some point this will pay off, because that was the advice everybody had. You know, the previous government actually held really tightly onto the currency. The president directed the central bank governor to control it very tightly, and so on. So it didn't help that, you know, there were still foreign exchange shortages, but the value they held the value at a sort of false level. And so now it's gone crazy. And so obviously MTN is a very, you know, big investor in Nigeria. So this matters. But there are many other companies, including other mobile phone companies, that have reported the same thing. So, you know, it's a long game. And I know that MTN has already had a long game in Nigeria, but it's still their biggest market. There is still a lot of people. There's huge appetite. And as they're rolling out new products and so on, there is a big market waiting to take up those products as well. And obviously, he would have broken down that they have done pretty well in a lot of areas. It's just really this devaluation. And I think it obviously wasn't only Nigeria. Ghana has also been through Miller, and there's other countries as well. So, I think that, you know, everybody is feeling the pinch, but in the last 10 days or so, the currency has started rebounding. The president has not sat still through all of this, and his team. They have really tried to pull out all the stops to stop people spending, taking money out of the country, trying to get Forex coming in, and all sorts of schemes and so on, including actually just this last week, forbidding any overseas travel by his ministers and government officials for the next 3 months, which, you know, the government officials seem to really like traveling. And Nigeria had one of the biggest delegations at the COP meeting in January, absolutely. I think it was. So, you know, it came under a lot of criticism of that while telling people that they've got to hold the line on this historic issue. So we're hoping, I think everybody is hoping that actually this improvement is going to be steady and well, let's see. I mean, I think MTN being such a flagship kind of investor in Nigeria really reminds, you know, their results really remind everybody of the crisis that Nigeria is in at the current.
Talk to me about South Africa's banks in the rest of Africa. The strategies for many years were expanding beyond South Africa's borders, beyond the African continent. And in the last 5 or 6 years, global capital requirements and new opportunities were few and far between. And so it's seen a refocusing by South African financial institutions almost universally on the African continent. And finally, it's beginning to pay off. I reminded Sim Chabalala last night that, you know, while he is reaping the benefits of the investment that has been made in Standard Bank's operations outside of South Africa and the African continent, these things started, you know, 30 years ago, maybe even more years ago, where people were saying, you know, this is the continent of the future, this is the continent worth investing in. And you don't get speedy returns on this continent, particularly in highly regulated and massively volatile environments.
Well, I think that's true. And as you say, again, it's a long game. And Standard Bank has been a leader. Certainly, they've got the biggest footprint. I think it's around 20 countries, including South Africa. And it was always the sense that, yes, Africa would eventually pay off. And I think a lot of boards in this country said to you know, their CEOs and MDs, no, we're not taking that kind of risk too long term. We don't know where it's going and it's up and down, etc. And we are still in that situation, really, I suppose. But it seems to be that, you know, having just talked about MTN, but obviously that's quite specific to a few countries, you know, one of the bigger your footprint in Africa, the more you spread your risk. And I think that's when it starts to pay off. I mean, some of our banks don't have a very big footprint. Absa is relatively small. Nedbank has this tie-up with Echo Bank, which is doing quite well. So Nedbank is benefiting from that. But I think it's that spread of the risk, the massive diversity and growth. And, you know, there's quite a lot of high-growth countries in Africa predicted for this year. I think I spoke about this in my last sort of outing on this program. And so obviously the banks, you know, if there's high GDP growth, there will be some spin-off for the banks. But also risk in itself is business for banks, you know, the spread of risk, the risk and hedging products, et cetera. And the growth is largely, as I understand it, in the corporate and investment banking side. So that says that, you know, people are interested in Africa. There is investment happening. Obviously, people are picking and choosing their sectors, their markets, and so on. And you have to do the hard yards behind the scenes to make sure you're in the right place at the right time. But the numbers are quite high in this, in the banking results, you know, recently. I mean, in for Standard Bank, Rest of Africa accounts for more than 40% of total earnings. Yeah. Absa Africa region profits doubled, so now contributing 30% of group earnings, while South Africa is in decline, etc. So, you know, RMB also 24% growth from Rest of Africa. So as South Africa is kind of wobbling, we are seeing growth. And of course, South Africa is one country, and the growth is coming across the region for these different banks. But it is interesting. I mean, as you say, I think what you said is absolutely spot on. I mean, we've heard this and heard this and heard, and it hasn't really happened. And now suddenly that kind of tide is turning. And the banks would be able to tell you more accurately about what is happening there. But, you know, we are seeing quite a continent that's come through a lot of stuff and it's become quite resilient. We are seeing growth. Sub-Saharan growth is above average, above other regions, predicted for this year, etc. Although, you know, this debt distress, devaluation, these are huge risks to profit. And I mean, there's no gain saying that, you know, the opportunities are all there. These are big issues in many countries. So that is something that banks obviously have to build in into, and maybe we will see a bit of decline in that growth in the coming year because these are still big issues in Africa.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. There's a line from a Robert Burns poem called To a Mouse. If you translate it from the ancient language, it goes, "The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry." What do you do when your financial planning has not gone well? I quote Robert Burns. You've got a far more astute philosopher, I think, you'd like to quote here, Warren Ingram.
My all-time great philosopher in modern times is that genius Mike Tyson, who also kind of did a little bit of boxing on the side, and you know, everyone had a game plan about how to beat Mike Tyson because they said he was so predictable. I guess it's a bit like the Springboks in 2019, and Mike's answer was very simple. You know, everyone has a plan until they get hit. And I think it applies beautifully to financial planning, Bruce.
Yeah, absolutely. And so often we set off with the great big plans. You sit down, you plan it, and then life happens. And unfortunately, when life happens, life can get very expensive and things can go horribly wrong through no fault of anybody's, frankly, in terms of the financial outcomes. But stuff just goes pear-shaped. What sort of things do you see people presenting you with, Warren? They come to you and they're 50-something and they're going, "It's not worked out. Help."
It's amazing how we all think we're so unique and different from our friends and neighbors and colleagues at work. But when you analyze the way people approach their financial planning, it seems that we tend to start taking it seriously round about the age of 48. And that's usually when people reach out to a financial planner, and that seems to happen to me quite a bit. Is somewhere around age 48 to 52, 55, I get these frantic messages. You know, it's too late. I've left it too late. I don't know what to do. You know, should I just kind of work and until I die? You know, so, something like that, or sometimes a little bit less dramatic. And it's just amazing to me that we think that, you know, time is something that only works against us, you know. And it's true that if you ignore your money and you've got big money issues, then time starts to race against you, because your problems tend to compound as your interest and your debts grow. But equally, if you're 55, let's use your example, 55 years old, and you believe that it's too late and everything's over, I always think to myself, you know, life expectancy for most of us will be somewhere around, let's say, 85 to 90. And that means at age 55, you've got, you know, 30 to 40 years to get things right. You know, a retirement age of 65 is not a compulsory thing. You don't have to stop work and kind of just go and sit on the rocking chair and, you know, look at the view, even if it's someone's back wall. You can do something. You can take action. And giving yourself 10 years is kind of a death sentence, because you think at 55, all you've got is, you know, the next 10 years is frankly crazy. I think it starts with changing your attitude to what you can do and how long you can do it, and the steps you can take to rectify your position.
The myth of the 60, 65-year-old retirement age, I think, is being revisited practically everywhere. And I call it a myth because I think unless you've had some sort of massive executive job where you've been given buckets of share options over time that have miraculously all vested on your retirement date and you've been given big piles of cash, very few people can realistically hope to retire to any standard that they have become accustomed to at that sort of age. So it is about being completely honest about it and saying, all right, there is a problem here. Fix the problem rather than sit fretting, losing sleep and panicking about it. Let's get an action plan. So what sort of action plan can we begin to assemble here?
I like that word you used, honesty, because I think it starts with a little bit of FaceTime with the mirror. And you know, understanding that the solution to the problem is staring you in the mirror, but equally the cause of the problem might also be staring in the mirror. It's one of those things where you have to sit down and say, okay, it hasn't worked out the way I would like to now, and I can make you know, a whole lot of excuses. And potentially, you know, it might be incredibly bad luck, and it could be that, you know, your plans got derailed through circumstances far beyond your control. That's certainly the case, but it requires honesty to also figure out if you are part of the problem, you know, and if you are, this is not a blame game. There is no one to blame. You're sitting there between yourself and your mirror and potentially a piece of paper and a pen, and the deal now is identify why things went wrong. If it's all down to luck, then I'm terribly sorry. But equally, it could be partly luck, partly, you know, some bad habits, and partly some bad decisions. And starting to understand the root cause of why things went wrong will also give you a great signal as to how things can go right from here. And I think it's, you know, a lot of people simply don't control their money. You know, and what I mean is that they get a good income, especially later in life, and they focus on their expenses in terms of what needs to be covered, but often pay very little attention to the investing and the saving part. Lots of these expenses are deemed absolutely necessary. You know, you can't live without it. And when you're faced with kind of a dose of reality, often those expenses that you can't live without are not so necessary. And again, that comes back to a bit of honesty now, is to say, okay, I've got, you know, maybe 10 years of peak earning, you know, maximum income generation, and maybe another 10 or 15 years of less income generation. But I can't keep spending as if I'm earning the maximum income forever, because that's why I'm in the situation I'm in today. So I think it's, number one, identify why things went wrong. Number two, figure out what are the basic needs, what are the most basic goals that you can set yourself given your new reality. And we used to speak a lot about the FIRE movement, you know, financially independent, retire early. And I think it, you know, it certainly got a bad rap because, you know, people were aiming to stop work at age 30. And you know, planning to live an absolutely basic life, you know, in the woods, almost, you know, eating one snack bar a week and living, you know, under a tree, and certainly that wasn't good. But you can learn some lessons from the FIRE movement, and one of them is, you know, pare life down to its necessities first. Understand what's absolutely required, you know, and that would be, you know, the most obvious, most basic things: food, shelter, medical cover, and some transportation. And from there, get those sorted out. Start figuring out how you're going to fund those expenses into your later years. And then start to look at everything else as nice to have. And it's amazing once you get that set of that mindset going, how suddenly life isn't so difficult to fund if you've got some capital and you're earning some income. How you can start to save for the readjusted goals, and maybe it's not going on overseas trips all the time and, you know, going to the coast every holiday, but you can take care of the basics first, and then find new ways of getting a new form of luxury that's still rewarding.
And it doesn't have to be a miserable process, Warren. Again, this idea of persistence and positivity, not la-la, you know, but the sort of positivity which causes you to ignore Armageddon. It's a case of, well, is Armageddon avoidable? Yes, it is. Let's take action to prevent Armageddon. And that is the sort of positivity, because that says this is still in my control.
Absolutely. And I think we can learn a lot of lessons from people who are in their last years. It's amazing when you talk to people, you know, who kind of, you know, let's say, you know, mid to late 80s, and they're often giving away stuff, you know, and I mean stuff and, you know, material things. They want less, and they want smaller properties and smaller cars, and, you know, they're forever giving away furniture and stuff to their children who, you know, already have full houses and don't want that stuff. But the important point there is they realize all the material things that they've accumulated over time that were completely invaluable to them, you know, at certain stages of their life, they realize actually generate very little meaning in life once you pare it down to the things that are most important. And interestingly, as that happens, and people do this proactively, you find their attitudes become somewhat happier. You know, the less stuff you have, the less things you have to worry about. Somehow the more happy you get. And I would like to suggest that as an attitude when you're sitting at age 55 in a big house with lots of stuff and, you know, cars that you absolutely have to have, apparently. And all of a sudden you start to say, really, you know, is this really what's going to drive life forward and give meaning? And not one of the material objects that you desire will give you any kind of meaning in life. You know, I think once you've taken care of the basics, everything else is about, you know, the social capital you have, the family that you have, and the things that you can do with your time. It's about having purpose, and all of that, it becomes a virtual positive circle. And it's not about the stuff that you can't buy and the holidays you can't go on. So for me, your attitude is really key here. You know, if we're getting to being honest, if we're getting to revisiting your goals, then understanding what really drives and a meaning in life is equally important. And I think allied to that, you know, if you're forced out of the corporate world at age 63 or 65 because companies have no vision and believe that you're useless after the age of 65, that's their loss. You know, you shouldn't buy into that nonsense and understand that you have enormous value. And often, you know, people at that stage of life have time, have enormous experience, and they can be incredibly valuable resources to smaller businesses, to people who are, you know, full up on their, on, you know, double income families that are full up on careers and no time, and you can find new ways to generate income. And even if it's not you know, at the maximum salary that you used to earn, earning additional cash flow you know, later in life is a double whammy, because you're benefiting from an income that's coming in and capital that you don't have to draw on, which is, you know, money that can be spent later in life when you really can't work you know, anymore. But the other big point here is you have purpose, you have meaning, you're making a difference to people's lives, and that has a huge impact on your own psychology and those around you. So you know, thinking about this whole situation very differently and from from, as I say, from that positive mindset, I think is enormously valuable and valuable psychologically, but also financially. You know, and I think that you shouldn't lose sight of when you think everything's gone wrong.
Warren Ingram is a certified financial planner. He's a founder and director at Galileo Capital. A letter this evening. I say letter. That's a big title. An email, a message, a short question. There we go. I think that's the truth. Saying, my wife and I recently tied the knot and we are working on our financial future together. Oh, that is romantic, actually. What is the best way to do a budget for a couple? Should we each have our own budgets or should we have one household budget? Is it good to have joint bank accounts? Well, you can't have joint bank accounts. You can have bank accounts in one person's name that you both put in. It's such an antiquated, for all of the great advances in South Africa's banking and the superiority to many banking systems in the world, the one thing where we do fall short is the joint bank account. That is my strong opinion on this. But Simon would like some help on that. Warren, we'll do that in a moment.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
To Simon's question, Warren, the getting married and managing household finances, joint finances, the cost of living together, the cost of growing together. In an ideal world, you just kind of put all your money into a single pot and draw from that and budget and plan from that. Not everybody's wired that way, though. So what is the beginner's guide to this process?
I think possibly for the third time ever, I'm going to disagree with you. To me, the ideal world is we each earn our own money, and we set our fund goals for ourselves, and we allocate some money to a joint account for the household expenses. But we never reduce financial independence of the individuals in the marriage, and I think it's a key point here. You know it's such a romantic idea to kind of say, let's just club together and put everything in one pot. The problem with that is it often removes one person's sense of independence, and you know, there will be often in a relationship one person who's just more kind of, you know, savvy around money or more focused on it and the other person not, and it ends up kind of becoming a power play in relationships as the couple get older, where the one person is kind of controlling everything and the other one feels that they're working hard earning but can't have control over a portion of their money. So I think it's a magic question, Simon. I love it, but I think it starts with just understanding that, you know, money is very often a cause of real conflict in a relationship. So step one, you need to sit down together and say, what are our joint goals? What are the things that we are aiming for together? You know, whether it's going to be a property one day, whether it's going to be children one day, who knows? All of the things that you're planning for together, and then set aside, you know, money from each of your accounts to work towards those goals. And by all means, have joint accounts. And as Bruce says, you know, it can't be a joint bank account, but you can kind of each access an account and move money, you know, in and out of that account. But certainly, you know, have joint accounts for the groceries or decide how you're going to divide up, you know, the family expenses now that you are a family. But always create space and scope for each of the people in the relationship to have money that they spend on their own luxuries. And I'm not saying that money that gets set aside shouldn't be disclosed to the other party. There's nothing about secrecy here, but it's about making sure that both of you feel you have some control over your own assets and expenses, and that you have joint goals. And you know, I mean, it's a horrible thing to discuss when you've just got married, but be realistic to know that half of marriages don't work out, and so keeping a clear separation of, you know, the things that you brought into the marriage, especially around investments, you know, it's quite empowering, and it becomes you actually remove a source of conflict from a relationship where both people have their own investments, have some money of their own, and then share goals. And I think, I mean, it's not to prescribe, you know, for those that want to kind of chuck everything together, that's great, do it, but then have proper conversations about what do we do when one person is feeling you know that they can't get access to money that they're earning, and what happens when one is overspending on mountain bikes and the other one is just saving like crazy and doing nothing, spending nothing, how do we resolve those kinds of conflicts as a couple? So I think conflict resolution is important, figuring out how you're going to fight about money and how you're going to resolve the issues and then never remove the sense of control.
No, I mean, your answer is much better than mine and far more circumspect and far more realistic, Warren, because, again, that sense of financial independence is critical, because if, should one party in that relationship choose not to stick around, they've got the freedom to do so. And they're not trapped in a relationship. And so many people do get stuck in those relationships. So I take your approach. It is a very good and smart approach. My apologies for being so naive, because you do see, unfortunately, the brutal realities of when things do go wrong, unfortunately, and prepared is better than unprepared.
I think if you're not feeling trapped, and you're free to be in a relationship without financial kind of handcuffs, it I think allows for a much healthier relationship, and that's important. And secondly, if there is a controlling person in the relationship and they're acting badly, then that freedom to leave with access to financial resources is a wonderful gift to give yourself. So I'm not suggesting that you go into the relationship planning to leave, but being able to and staying in a relationship because of choice rather than because you're forced, it to me, sounds like the great way to be in a marriage and building a future together.
There we go. We wrap it all up this evening. Thank you, Warren Ingram, who is an executive director at Galileo Capital and a certified financial planner.